Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCRIT podcast. So I did a talk on sepsis at SMAC, the best resuscitation conference ever, and you'll notice it hasn't gone up on the MCRIT website. Why not? Well, because I was waiting for today when the ARISE trial was published. We all knew it was coming, and it dropped, I think, a couple days ago. And that allows me now to contextualize my severe sepsis talk in the setting of now the second huge re-examination of early goal-directed therapy. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is a little bit on ARISE, which was an amazing trial, and then the state of severe sepsis in the opinion of me in 2014. So let's get right to it. So I am not going to summarize the entire ARISE trial because the Bottom Line folks, the Bottom Line blog, did it for me. So just go over to mcrit.org and you will see a link to their site. And I embedded the actual summary into the website after getting permission, of course. And it goes over all the little details that you may want to know. So I don't need to. And we'll talk about some of these little details that I find interesting. But if you want a summary of the whole trial, go there. Or read critical care reviews, which also was sent out with a beautiful summary of this stuff. It's all there. And then I also, on the website, have videos from Sandra Peak, one of the lead investigators, discussing her thoughts on the trial. So all that stuff is there, so I don't have to do it. But let's talk about this. Now, this was an amazingly well-wrought trial. The randomization, all of the methodology, quite nice. And my fear is that the beauty and impact of this trial may get swept under the rug because it's the second one published. And everyone was going gaga over process. And this one, they might, oh, said the same as process. And that would be dreadfully unfair because this is such a good trial. Now, what did this one do differently than process? Well, first of all, it's not just one country, it's many countries. So in addition to the ANZICS countries, Australia and New Zealand, there's also countries like parts of Ireland and Finland and Hong Kong and other countries I'm forgetting. I'm sorry if you were in those countries. But the point is, multinational trial. Great. But here's the real important one. It wasn't just in big academic centers. It was in small EDs, small ICUs, community-type places, meaning that the arguments of the Surviving Sepsis Campaign folks that we can't apply process because it was only in big academic centers, I think, no longer applies. And if they're going to still hold out that everyone should be doing standard, you know, textbook early goal-directed therapy at this stage of the game after this trial comes out, well, head in sand is coming to mind. It would be a big problem in my mind if they don't revise it. I know what they're going to do, and they're going to say, we're going to wait for promise. But I think that's a mistake. I think one more day going by without revising their recommendations is unfair to the clinicians and the patients. But that's just the opinion of me, the little guy. I don't count because I don't have a big group. I just have a little podcast. All right, enough of that. Let's get into it. So multiple countries, small community places in addition to academic shops, and they just, you know, straight up two groups, not the three groups of process, two groups, straight up early goal-directed therapy versus pragmatic care. What is pragmatic care? Whatever the clinicians thought best. The only thing they couldn't do is stick and monitor central venous oxygen saturations. And that's the only thing they weren't allowed. Everything else, just as they wanted to do. Now, remember that. So when I start teasing Chris Nixon and the other Australians, you'll understand that, you know, this was they had free rein to do whatever critical care they wanted to do. So what did happen in the trial? Well, the first thing to talk about is there's really no significant mortality difference of any of their outcome measures between the two groups. That wasn't unexpected, especially after process, and most of us have been predicting this for quite a bit of time, but there you go. So no difference. That's the big take-home message. Now, the little take-home messages that I find fun is friends like Chris, you know, the guy who likes to beat people on the chest when they go into cardiac arrest, have told me that the Australians, the New Zealands, they're much more judicious with their fluid, that we flood patients in the States, and we really are giving these patients too many fluids, we're killing them. You know, Paul Marek is telling us that we're flooding patients with the paradigms of early goal-directed therapy. So let's look at this, because this is interesting. Now, you got to understand, in both ARISE and in PROCESS, the patients got fluid prior to randomization and entry into the trial. If they were hypotensive, then they needed that fluid, first off, to get even in the criteria of severe sepsis in the first place. ARISE used 1 liter after hypotension to be enrolled in the severe sepsis group, and you know, most other trials use 2 liters, and PROCESS actually decreased as they were going. But the point is, it doesn't matter. Because both groups, both groups got about 2.5 liters before randomization. So even before the zero mark of this trial, they got 2.5 liters. The real numbers were 2515, 2,515 mLs of fluid in the early goal-directed therapy group, and then 2,591 mLs of fluid in the pragmatic care group. So both of them got about 2.5 liters. Remember that, because that's not exemplified when people just look at the amount of fluid in the abstract. You know, most people just read the abstract, and they're like, oh, they're not very much fluid at all, blah, 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 flooding. Australians, very judicious, blah. But no. They got 2.5 liters before they even entered into the randomization. And then in the early goal-directed therapy group, an additional 1964, so about an additional 2 liters of fluid. And here we go, in the pragmatic care group, you know, those incredibly careful with fluid, Australian and New Zealand's, and you guys all know I love my Australian and New Zealand friends. You know, I think these guys are providing the best critical care in the world. But what they didn't do is give very little fluid, because in their group, 1,713. So the real difference between the post-randomization is about 250 mLs. Of fluid. That's the big difference between incredibly judicious, careful fluid administration and early goal-directed therapy. And since there was 80 cc's more fluid in the pragmatic group, it wasn't even that much in the overall fluid received by both groups. We're talking, it was statistically significant, but totally clinically irrelevant. Around 200 mLs of fluid difference between just strictly following early goal-directed therapy and doing what you think is the best critical care for this patient in terms of fluid administration. So that's one take-home message, but that's not the main take-home message. The main take-home message to my mind is now, after both process and ARISE, we have a number of mLs of fluid that these patients should probably get, unless you have a very good reason to diverge from this, and that is somewhere between 3, 4, maybe 4.5 liters of fluid. I would just, you know, round it down. I would say most patients deserve 3 to 4 liters of fluid in their first 6 hours, unless you have a great reason to do so. And that great reason probably should be something like you did an actual objective measure of whether they're still volume responsive, and that's why you decided to give less. So if you're going to go empiric, I've been saying it without these trials, and I will say it with evidence behind me, these patients should probably receive 3 to 4 liters of fluid in the first 6 hours if you're going with an empiric treatment strategy. Now, PRBCs were, as we'd expect, there was about double the transfusion rate in the early goal-directed therapy group, but surprisingly, a very low overall transfusion rate, even in the early goal-directed therapy group, as opposed to the enormous number of patients that received blood in the early goal-directed therapy original trial. Only 13.6% of patients got blood by strict protocol in this trial. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us what we have suspected for a long time, which is in the original Manny Rivers trial, a lot of patients were receiving blood because the clinicians thought the patients would benefit from it as opposed to following their own protocol. And that's okay, but it really led people down a path of thinking that maybe giving a lot of blood is what made early goal-directed therapy tick, and I really don't think it was. And so, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, double the rate, but the rate itself was not that high, even in the early goal-directed therapy group. Now, there's some surprising things about how sick these patients were. A lot of patients entered by lactate criteria. About half of the patients made it by lactate as opposed to resistant hypotension. This is different than trials like Jones's group, where very few patients got in by lactate. And the lactates themselves that got them in were quite high, an average of 6.7, 6.6 between in the two groups. Those are high lactates. These patients are pretty sick. That wasn't necessarily reflected by their Apache scores. I don't know what to do with that discrepancy between those two facts, but who cares, because they actually subsetted the Apache patients and the results were basically the same. A lot of patients got A-lines in the first 6 hours. In the early goal-directed therapy group, 91%, which you'd expect because that was part of the early goal-directed therapy protocol arm. But even in the pragmatic care group, 76%, almost three-quarters of the patients had A-lines. I think that's a little bit more aggressive than many small community shops in the States, and I love it. I think it's the right thing to do. In the pragmatic group, 61% of the patients still got central lines. So, you know, you didn't save central lines in a lot of these patients. That's because a lot of these patients needed vasopressors. Around the same amount of patients needed vasopressors as got central lines. Dobutamine, 15% in early goal directed therapy and 2.6% in the pragmatic care group. And that probably is reflective of the fact that most of the folks, the countries in this trial don't believe in dobutamine. And I don't even know personally what the role is in many patients. So I don't have any problem with that at all. What's my last take home before we go into the overall message I think this trial allows us to take? Well, I think it definitely says to me that we have no need of rigorous early goal-directed therapy. You do not need to put a central line in. You do not need to measure CVP, and you do not need to get central venous oxygen saturation. And I've been saying that for years on the podcast. I have an entire sepsis collaborative that I was co-chair of built around that fact. And now we have even more evidence to say it. There is no reason to do, in my mind, standard early goal-directed therapy. But let's just flip this around for 1 second and give credit where credit is due. I would say that the original Rivers trial and Manny Rivers himself was the one that allowed us to get to the level of care we're at now, that pragmatic therapy actually does as well as the early goal-directed therapy trial. And I think we have to acknowledge that fact. And we'll go one step further and say that 13 years after his trial, the pragmatic care group did not beat his protocol, that it was basically the same. Well, think about that. It means in 13 years, the original Rivers protocol still holds up. That if you did decide to do that, and I don't think you should, but if you did, you'd be providing probably just as good care as the people that were using all their clinical mindset and skills and analysis of what's going on to make clinical care decisions. That if you still followed early goal-directed therapy, you would do okay. But don't, because it's not necessary. Okay, let's go into the general message section now. So where are we in severe sepsis care in 2014? Big messages here, not the little niche stuff I talk about elsewhere on the podcast. What are the big ways we should be going, in my opinion? Well, first of all, we have the recognition piece. You got to find them early. You got to locate them. You have to have a protocol for locating these patients. Both PROCESS and ARISE had a protocol for locating these patients. It was the same one in the Rivers trial. If they had SIRS criteria, they had a lactate sent. If they had SIRS plus a lactate greater than or equal to 4, boom, severe sepsis. Or if they had SIRS criteria and persistent hypotension after a reasonable amount of fluid, severe sepsis. And I personally use our Stop Sepsis campaign modification of the SIRS criteria, which does not require a WBC, a white cell count. And that is on the mcrit.org/134 show notes for this episode. And that one allows you to actually screen them at triage and let the triage nurses send off the lactate. And if they are borderline hypotensive, initiate the initial fluid bolus so that you can know really quick whether or not these patients are severe sepsis and locate them early, because early recognition is super important. I am not going to belabor lactate right now because I could go on for another 30 minutes. People are trying to bash lactate, and there are some reasons to bash lactate, but lactate has no ability to be bashed as a screen for severe sepsis. Regardless of the reason their lactate is elevated, if you have a septic patient with an elevated lactate, they tend to die if you do not do anything, and it's a great screen. And people who say, oh, it's not sensitive and specific, are ignoring the fact that it is a combined screening test. The combined screening test is lactate or persistent hypotension. And those two together screen real nice. Okay, let's go to treatment. Here are your treatment priorities. And I'm going to go through them right now all together, and then I'll break them down and go through them one by one. So early antibiotics, source control, don't kill them when intubating. Give them the right amount of fluid, early, properly selected vasopressors, then check your work and make sure you actually did them good, and then put them somewhere where they won't die alone. All right, let's go through each of these. Antibiotics. We had the original trials from Kumar and Gajewski, and now we have a new one that was just published in Critical Care Medicine, which I'm not going to talk about because I just linked to the bottom line blog summary of it, and just check it out there. But essentially what all these say, and they're all retrospective and they're all associative, not definitive, but what they all say is early antibiotics are better. Now, I'm going to go a step further, and I've said this elsewhere, but I think it's really important I say it now. If you have any sick patient, any critically ill patient, and you're not quite sure what's going on, maybe it's sepsis, maybe it's something else, err on the side of empirically giving them antibiotics. Any sick patient, any patient who's hypotensive, any patient that looks like crap and you're worried they're going to die, just give them antibiotics. More and more, we're finding that pretty much every critical illness state early on probably benefits from antibiotics. I'm sure there's some that don't, but if you had to err one way or the other and you're not sure what's going on, you're not sure definitively that it's not something antibiotics will help, give the antibiotics. Give a spectrum of antibiotics that will cover any possible source in this patient. Now, why do I say do this for any sick patient, even if you don't know what's going on? Well, we're finding out post-arrest patients probably should get antibiotics. We know GI bleeds from varices with cirrhotics should get antibiotics. If you have a severe brain injury and they're going to need a interventricular pressure monitoring, they should get antibiotics sooner rather than later. If you have a trauma patient and they're going to get cut or intervened on, it's better to have the antibiotics in sooner so that when the knife hits the belly, they already have those in their bloodstream. I can't think of too many critical ill conditions where antibiotics are not necessarily a great idea. So be very judicious when they're not sick and be incredibly aggressive with early antibiotics if they're sick and there's even the slightest potential that they have something with antibiotics will benefit. All right, enough of that rant. Source control, I've belabored elsewhere sufficiently, I think. You got to get out the dirty lines, you got to get out the sick organ, and you got to actually take care of the neck fascia because antibiotics don't do so well with that. Next up, don't kill them with the tube. Here's a great way to save a whole bunch of patients in a collaborative sepsis effort. Teach people not to kill them when intubating. Cliff Reed has discussed about his hatred for propofol and other ways of killing patients in the intubation. I have an entire lecture on it, also from SMAC. Just go to mcrit.org/134 and you'll find the link to that lecture. Give the right amount of fluids. And I've already said what I think that right amount is if you're going empirically. I think there is a benefit to doing a quick echo, a quick look at the IVC and a quick look at the lungs and putting all that together and making some kind of strategy. But I think what you'll come out to is exactly what Process and Arise did, which is most of these patients in the first 6 hours should get 3 to 4 liters. Now, the next one, early vasopressors, ties into what I just said, because I will say that if you have given 3 to 4 liters and you still think the patient needs more fluids, they probably deserve first to be put on a reasonably low dose of norepinephrine, something like 3, 4, 5 mics, before you give any additional fluid, because the first effect of vasopressors is to squeeze the venous side and actually augment your cardiac preload, therefore do the same thing you would by flooding them with additional fluid, without having to give them extra fluid. You're just, you know, squeezing down, stressing the tank on the venous side, and therefore you may not need additional fluids after you gave 3 liters and put them on 3 micrograms of norepi, even though you might have without the norepi itself. So early vasopressors, we're finding out more and more, may be a good way to go. So that's what we're talking about here. You know, like something like 3 or 4 liters of fluid and then 3 or 4 mics of norepi. It can initially be given through a peripheral IV. I have an entire podcast about that, a randomized controlled trial by Ricard, saying it's okay. And I think it is okay. I don't think it's okay long-term, personally. I would much rather have a line that won't get knocked out easily if they need vasopressors to support their blood pressure. But early on, we just put them on peripherally, make sure it's a good IV. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I have a podcast on it. And then check your work, which means for me, I'm still sending serial lactates. At some point, we'll actually publish our 200 patients out of Elmhurst showing that if the patient initially had an elevated lactate, clearance demonstrates a marked reduction in mortality compared to patients that can't clear, as opposed to the patients who never had an elevated lactate. Those guys, whether they clear or not, they do equally well, but I still send the repeat lactate. If it's spiking up, that's bad. If they dropped and then respiked, even worse. So there, I think there's value to that. By all means, add in a clinical assessment of how they're doing, you know, things like all of a sudden they woke up from their sepsis-induced encephalopathy, their vitals are all better, they're making urine, blah, 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 blah. But some way, have something in your mind that you go back and look at the patient. I think that's really the key benefit to checking your work, to getting that second lactate, is it proves that someone actually saw the patient after the initial resuscitation. Someone actually cared enough to go back and look at them. And if you have to ask for another blood test in order to make that happen, well, so be it. But you got to keep looking at these guys. You know, you got to keep rounding on them and making sure they're not getting worse, making sure their endotracheal tube didn't get disconnected, that they the vasopressors are now dripping on the floor because the IV fell out and the pump's been beeping for 2 hours and no one checked. So that's probably the primary benefit of whatever reassessment strategy you have, is it forces you to reassess. All right, and then the last part, put them in a monitored setting. Put them somewhere that if they drop dead, someone will realize it real quick and start coding them and bringing them back, as opposed to sticking them on our regular floor or sending them home, when they have their sudden cardiac arrest in those places, they get a tendency to get missed for a while. And that generally makes them a lot harder to bring back. And that's it. I think that's the key take-homes, that if you did that stuff, you get a majority of the benefit. Or as I like to say, you don't have to do a lot of shit. You just have to give a shit. And if you do that, I think you get almost all of the mortality benefits in severe sepsis care. I'm sorry if I've offended the ears of the gentle listeners with my cussing. All right. Is there any other stuff to talk about? Sure. Blood. Blood. We now have the TRIS trial out. It's linked in the show notes, saying what we've known for, I think, at least 10 years now. Your hemoglobin trigger should probably be 7. Of interest in this trial, because I think this was something I wanted answered, these guys in this new TRIS trial I linked to actually used leukoreduced blood. So, I mean, that was my thought is, well, are we hurting patients with the liberal blood because it's not leukoreduced and we're causing all kind of immunomodulatory effects? And no, they use leukoreduced blood, still no benefit for going above 7. So 7 grams, what is it, 7 grams per deciliter? Shit. I don't know. 7 is your trigger. If they're less than 7, give it. If they're greater than 7, you probably shouldn't. That's what our Stop Sepsis Collaborative said as well. Okay, dobutamine, who the hell knows? Is there a definitive patient niche for this? I don't know. I will sometimes give it if the patient on echo has really crappy heart function, and I think that's part of their hypotension, though I must admit that after doing fellowship last year and spending a lot of time in the cardiothoracic ICU, I'm kind of using epinephrine as my inotrope, and I very rarely reach for dobutamine anymore. And I am doing things like I put them on norepi for their MAP, and then if I throw the echo on and their heart's not doing great, I will add inotropic doses of epinephrine as opposed to dobutamine, so I don't know. All right, that's what I got. I'm sure you have an opinion, and gosh darn it, I want to hear it. So put it in the comments for this, and I will respond, because I always do respond to any comments you put in the podcast show notes. And that's all I got. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.